Yeah? Okay. Yeah, good morning, everybody. My name is Simone Fischer-Hübner, and I have the pleasure to moderate the session and also to present at the beginning. So this session is on privacy-enhancing technologies, and it will be a mixture of a tutorial, but also about research within European Union-financed projects, like the Prime Life project, and also Norwegian PetWeb 2 projects. So both deal with privacy-enhancing technologies and privacy-enhancing identity management. So, with me are two colleagues. My colleague Hans Hepum, also from Karlstadt University, is also working within privacy and identity management for several years, and is also active within the ISO, within standardization of privacy-enhancing identity management. And my other colleague is Lothar Fritsch from the Norwegian Computer Center, who is also has been cooperating with us within the previous European project PRIME on privacy and identity management for Europe, and is now heavily involved in the PetWeb 2 project in Norway, and will also present a bit more about that. So I will start to give a short introduction into privacy-enhancing technologies and privacy-enhancing identity management. Then my colleague Hans will continue on transparency-enhancing tools. And finally, Lothar will talk about PETS, privacy-enhancing technologies for location-based services, and also about business aspects and business factors for PETS. And then afterwards, we also want to leave time for discussion and questions. So you're very welcome to get engaged in the debate. Directly after us is another session on Tor, so I tried not to overlap too much, so the focus, I will also have a bit about anonymity, but more about that will follow later in the session on Tor by Roger Dingeldine. Yeah, now I have to see how get started. Any idea how I find my presentations here? It's
somewhere in the folder.
Okay, here's a right. Okay. Yeah. So first of all, in the following, when I refer to privacy, I refer to informational self-determination. So privacy has several aspects. Informational self-determination means that we can control what data we release to whom, under which conditions, that means under which purposes, and for which retention period, under which obligations, and so on. So that is informational self-determination, that we can determine under which conditions we release personal data to others. Privacy has many other aspects, for instance, also spatial privacy. So we should have a sphere around us that is kept private from intrusions by others. So for instance, spam is also an important privacy aspect, but that will not be the focus of today. Privacy-enhancing technologies should map basic legal privacy principles into technical solutions. And when we look into the privacy laws and the EU Data Protection Directive, they are very important privacy principles that can be directly mapped into technologies. So first of all, data processing has to be legitimized. Usually we need informed consent. For this, the user interfaces have to be designed in a special way. Secondly, very important is the principle of data minimization, which can be derived from the directive. That means we have to minimize the amount of personal data and the extent to which the data is processed, because the best strategy for protecting privacy is simply not to collect any data at all. So privacy is best protected if we can also act anonymously or pseudonymously. Then important is also purpose specification and purpose binding. So And that's the reason for that is that the sensitivity of personal data is very much related to the purpose of use and the context of use. So actually there are no non-sensitive data. It always depends on the context and the purpose of use. So the purpose should be specified in advance, and we have, for this we need privacy policies, and also later we have to protect that the data is not, are not used for other purposes than those purposes that were specified beforehand. There are many examples of purpose misuses, for instance, in Germany by the Lidl supermarket chain 2 years ago, where they installed video cameras at the cashier with the official purpose to detect shoplifting, but in reality they used the video monitoring equipment to spy on the employees and to monitor their performance, and hired also detectives to evaluate what the employees were talking about, how they were dressed, how long breaks they did, and so on. So that is a typical example of purpose misuse that should be prevented. And another important principle among, yeah, also others is the principle of transparency. So it should be transparent what data are collected about us, how they are processed. And this is becoming more and more important also in the context of ambient intelligence. And my colleague Hans will talk more about transparency enhancing tools right after me. Yeah, for we have legal principles, so law is important, but for effectively protecting privacy, we should complement the law also by technical solutions, and the area of privacy enhancing technologies has become more and more important. Enforce legal privacy principles by technologies, and we have different types of PETs. So first of all, the PETs, or the best protection, as said, you can reach if you minimize or avoid personal data at all, if users can act anonymously or act under certain pseudonyms, if conversations are not observable for third parties, or if different activities, transactions cannot be linked so that users cannot be profiled. So here we have different techniques. Mixed nets is a basic technology. I'll briefly talk about that also later. Tor is implementing the mixed net idea for real-time communication, so that will be discussed in this session right after this one. Then there are other protocols for anonymous communication, but the most prominent or the most widely used one is actually Tor nowadays. Then, it's important actually anonymous communication that by default the communication can be anonymized, because then on application level we really have control what data we release to whom. We are not already identified. We have the power to decide under which conditions we release data about us, and we identify us to others. But we also need anonymization techniques on application level. So here we have also different protocols for anonymous payment schemes, anonymous voting. Anonymous credentials is a very important ingredient that I will come to that later also. And that we can also release only the minimal amount of data on application level. I don't know whether you're aware or whether you're familiar with anonymous credentials, by like the IDMix protocol by IBM or UProof technology, which is now rolled out by Microsoft, also in the SCART space. So it's getting more and more important. So probably you know about traditional credentials. So you have like attribute certificates where you have statements which are signed and where you can prove certain attributes. So you could, for instance, have a traditional electronic passport credential. And if you want to prove certain attributes, you would show your full Swedish passport, for instance. For instance, if you want to access a service and you have to show that you are an adult, have to show your birth date, but you show your whole passport and all attributes. So you show much more than is needed for this specific context. Anonymous credentials have the advantage that they are based on zero-knowledge proof, and they can only reveal a subset of attributes, or only show specific characteristics of attributes. So you could have an anonymous passport credential and then use it in the context to prove that you're over 18, and you could only show the proof that you're over 18 and no other attributes more, or nothing more. You don't have to show your exact birth date, your citizenship, or any other information from your passport. So that is really data minimization on application level. Yeah, anonymity, of course, is not always possible. We have many applications where we simply have to release personal data when we do our tax declaration or other applications, e-health applications. Then we still want to know, to trust the other side that they also treat our data according to legal privacy principles. So here, for instance, privacy policies come in that can be negotiated with the user or could make the privacy policy of the organization more transparent, and also enforcement schemes for reliably enforcing negotiated policies. And yeah, the third class is privacy-enhancing identity management, which is combining different kinds of state-of-the-art pets into an overall system where the user should really, in the end, have to control over their personal spheres. Yeah. Very short about anonymous communication, because that is really a basic building block before I come to privacy-enhancing identity management. May I ask how many are familiar with MixNets? So a couple, but not the majority. So I quickly browse through it because the next presentation goes also into a similar topic in more detail. So how is anonymous communication working? Very simply explained. So let's assume Alice wants to communicate with Bob. And Alice wants to stay anonymous, and she also doesn't want that another adversary, for instance, a network operator, can see that she's communicating with Bob. So if she sends her message directly, then of course she's not anonymous. So a simple solution could be that she sends it via a proxy server, which forwards the message on her behalf to Bob. Also incoming and outgoing messages could be reordered or mixed, so that you also an adversary who can see, monitor all the communication lines, cannot directly see who is communicating with whom. So that would work. However, now the server in the middle is a single point of trust, and if this gets compromised, then anonymity is lost. So already more than, almost 30 years ago, actually, David Chaum was concerned about privacy on the Internet in the context of email, and came up with this MixNet protocol, which is actually the basic building block also for anonymous system nowadays. So the idea is instead of that Alice sends the message directly to Bob or via a server, one server, it is routed via a series of servers, so-called mix stations, which are also mixing incoming and outgoing messages, so that Bob only sees that the message comes from the last big server, but he does not see it comes from Alice, and also none of the mixers on the route knows who is communicating with whom, unless they all cooperate. So this is, of course, a case that needs to be prevented. So how can these messages be routed in a form also that the message flow cannot be traced by a global adversary? So here, different layers of public key encryption are used. So the last message to be sent to Bob and Bob's address are encrypted with the public key of the last mix in the chain. Then Alice computer then computes another layer of encryption to prepare the message and encrypts it with the public key of the mix 2, the second mix, and adds the message to be sent to the third mix plus the address of the third mix. And finally, Alice computer encrypts the last layer of encryption for the first mix, encrypted with the public key of mix 1, and adds into it the message to be sent to mix 2 plus the address of mix 2. So after Alice computer has computed these layers of encryption. This is sent to the first mix, who can now peel off the first layer by decrypting it with its private key, finds the address of the next mix in the chain, and sends the rest of the message to mix two, which then also decrypts one layer, finds the next address to which it sends the remaining message. Mix three is then also decrypting this and finds the message to be sent to Bob. So this is how it basically works. Also, you see that the outlook of the messages are changed, so that it is not easy to follow the message flow. So this is the basic idea how you can communicate anonymously. So now neither Bob knows the message comes from Alice, but also a global adversary who can monitor all the communication lines should not find out who's communicating with whom. And this is possible as long as not all the mix on the path cooperated, and that if we assume that the encryption is secure. Okay, so this is how you can communicate anonymously. So this is a basic building block at that time for email, but the basic idea of this mix has also been taken over for real-time communication, and you will hear more in the next session. But let's continue to privacy-enhancing identity management. So here the idea is to enforce informational self-determination. Users should decide have better control over their personal fears. So in daily life, we typically play different roles we communicate with different parties, and in dependence with whom we are communicating or what role we are playing, we typically also show different faces to different audiences. So we release different subsets of our personal attributes to different communication partners, so-called partial identities of us. We reveal to others under different circumstances. So the government knows our income tax data, for instance. Medical provider know our medical data. Our friends know our hobbies, and some data we would like to keep for ourselves. So this is the principle of audience segregation, which has been already analyzed by sociologists almost 50 years ago. And this has worked better in the offline world, but also in the online world, we want to regain or maintain control of individuals over their personal fears and over their partial identities. So here, the idea of privacy-enhancing identity management comes in, and Lothar, Hans, and me have researched that within the EU FP6 project Prime already, where we showed in cooperation with other partners, this project has been coordinated by IBM Research at that time, that privacy-enhancing identity management is feasible by integrating different state-of-the-art and novel pets into an overall system. So the idea is that the user has a toolbox where he can, first of all, by default, communicate anonymously with different communication partners, so all the communication is anonymized. On application level, the user has the choice either to stay anonymous or use different pseudonyms, which are here illustrated by the masks under different colors in regard to different service providers, so that the different transactions in regard to different service providers cannot be easily linked. Also, the user could use different pseudonyms in regard to one specific service provider for different transactions, for instance, for different shopping transactions with Amazon, he could use different pseudonyms so that the user cannot be easily profiled. And to release the minimal amount of data, he can use anonymous credentials on application level. In cases where personal data needs to be released, privacy policies and trust policies are used and negotiated, and then should be reliably enforced on the services side via sticky policies. And also data processing is made transparent with transparency-enhancing tools. About that, Hans will later present more. Yeah, how is it working more in detail? So here are some illustrating slides. First, data minimization on application level. So I already mentioned the tradition model is more like this. We request a service and have the request to log in typically. The user sends username password. So this means now that the user can be uniquely identified and profiled. You can see, a lot of data. The services site has a lot of data about her name, address, email address, credit card details, other profiling data like detailed interest profiles, browsing behavior, detailed mouse movement profiles, and so on. So this is not a very fortunate situation. So the idea in Prime has been that if there's a request of a service, the services side first can provide different options. Either the user can access the service via a pseudonym or with minimal data in that sense, like, for instance, it might be in a situation minimal that the user only proves that she has a valid subscription to the service, but nothing more. Nothing more is of interest. She has paid for a certain subscription and is authorized to use the service, so she doesn't need to send any further identifying information, no name, no credit card details, and so on. So that is the second option. Or the third option could be that she sends a proof that she has a valid subscription plus a proof for other attributes, for instance, if this is a site where she has to prove that she's over 18 to order, to see some movies, for instance, that are restricted to certain audiences. Then she can send via her anonymous credentials only the proof that she's over 18, but nothing more. So in the first situation, when she identifies herself as a pseudonym and sends a proof that she is the holder of the pseudonym, the services site could still profile her under the pseudonym, but still this is better than if she is completely identified. This also allows still some customization for the service. Of course, the risk is that the user could in the end be identified. The more often she is reusing this pseudonym. The best situation is therefore if she really only releases minimal data, so she sends a proof with her anonymous credentials that she has a certain subscription, valid subscription of a certain type, and then can access the service. Now she is completely anonymous, but the service site has the proof that she has the subscription, or she, in some situation, can also prove further details, further attributes with her anonymous credentials. This will also allow some degree of customization, so that is something in between these extremes. Yeah, this is data minimization on application level. As said, of course, this is not always possible. There are many situations where we simply have to reveal personal data. Then we still want to have assurance that our data are not misused. So here the traditional model is simply that we have to trust. If we create an account, the services side requests a lot of data. Yeah, we simply have to trust that they do not misuse our data, but we are not really sure. So this is not really fortunate. We send data because we want to have access to the service. Yeah, but we basically have no other choice. So in Prime Life, the idea is that we can also get guarantees from the services side that they are to some extent reliable. So if a user sends a request for a service, the services side would first send their data handling proposal, so the privacy policy in machine-readable form, with a request for personal data. The user can evaluate this, can send a counter request to get better trust and assurance information, evidences that this site is really trustworthy in regard to how it handles personal data, so in regard to privacy. The service side could respond, for instance, they have a privacy seal by the Europrice project. So this is a European project that is evaluating other sites for their privacy friendliness, whether they follow privacy procedures and have secure components installed. We can also have real-time assurance certificates that certain privacy-enhancing technologies are running. This can be certified by so-called real-time assurance control systems. The user could also, in addition, request information from white and blacklist provider, for instance, about sites that are blacklisted for bad privacy practices or bad consumer practices. Yeah, also Konsumentenverket in Sweden deals with such issues. And there are some lists in Sweden for that purposes. Then the user can evaluate the privacy policy, matches it with their own privacy preferences, evaluate the trust proofs from the other side and from third party, and then decide whether she wants to release personal data, sends back the possibly an adapted privacy policy plus her data or certificate proofs, and the negotiated policy should then also stick to the data and should be reliably enforced when the data is accessed at the service site. And if the data is sent to other third parties, this negotiated policy should also travel with the data and should also be reliably enforced at the third party site. So in this context, I mentioned also the privacy policy negotiation. So in Prime Life, we are developing, or colleagues at IBM and Microsoft and SAP mainly are involved in privacy policy languages that we develop in this purposes. Also W3C is involved to standardize this. So the privacy policy language in Prime Life basically allows the user or the data subject to specify under which condition she or he wants to release personal data. So who can access the data? For instance, only sites that have a privacy seal of the class silver. Data handling preferences. How is the data to be treated to be released? For instance, should only may it be used for marketed purposes or not? Or it should only be forwarded to sites that have a gold privacy seal, for instance. Could be authorizations, obligations, could be dictated by the user that she wants that the data is deleted after 2 years maximum. And then there are some generic preferences that apply for implicitly revealed data like IP addresses and cookies. Yeah, on the services side, we have policies that state, what data they want to process, information about that the user holds certain identity cards, personal data to reveal, conditions to satisfy, for instance, that the user is over 18. And then under which conditions, like for what purposes and what are the obligations that the service side promises, for instance, to delete the data after 1 year, and then also to the generic policy for the data that is implicitly revealed. So these two policies of the user and the services side are stated in executable, so they can be automatically read and compared, matched, and if there is correspondence, the user is informed that it is okay to go ahead. If there's a mismatch, the user should be also informed specifically and informed, what are the differences and how he can go ahead, whether he wants to overrule or whether he wants to decline. Prime Life, as said, is a EU FP7 project which is now ongoing and will end next summer. And as said, there's a lot of work on policies, also HDI, in the context also of identity management for social networks and so on. So if you're interested, there's also a website where you can find more information. So we continue now with Hans, who will present more on the work on transparency-enhancing tools in this context.
So am I online now? Okay.
And then in the end, we take questions and the discussion.
Do you have a microphone? Yeah. Seems to work as well. Just switching. Here. So, as Simone said, I'm Hans Heerboom, working cost as well, and I'm also involved in some of the standardization around this in ISO. So if anybody's interested, we need more people there. Please contact TK318 at CIS. It's a good idea, or contact me. I'm going to talk a little bit about transparency-enhancing technologies. And I normally speak Swedish, but I will keep English now just to keep the flow going so you don't have to retrain, and so that Simone and Lothar actually understands what I'm saying as well. So, you're going to hear about transparency in the next session as well, but that's transparency from a different standpoint, I think, than what we're talking about here. So, transparency privacy enhancing is actually transparency from my point of view towards where I leave my data and what's been done with the data I leave. So I don't really, we don't really look at it at the way of seeing how an organization works, but rather in a way of what's been done with my data, what data is out there about me, and how is it used. So specifically when we specify tools for these things, we talk about tools that have one or more of the following things. Either they provide information on intended collection, storage, and data processing to the end user. This is what we might call promises tools. And there's a lot of them out there now. The problem, of course, is that the tools that's out there now is what the speaker said before. It's legal text written for lawyers. So it's quite hard for a person to actually understand them. And even if you actually understand them, to see what rights you have. So one of the things here is to make it possible, maybe, to be able to automatically show those things. And the policies that Simone talked about before is one step towards this, where you actually can get information about how somebody's trying to do this. The other is tools that will give you information on personal data release and negotiated policies, which is what we might call a history tool. It's actually a tool that enables you to keep track on what you released out there, when you released it, to whom, and under which conditions. There are a couple of first tries here as well, out in the wild, where there, I think there's some trails in CardSpace, for example, where you used the different credentials. However, it's very limited at this point in time. There are other research projects that also has this. The third one is, of course, to tools that will make you actually get access to the data that's stored out there, i.e., what data does actually Google have about me? And also to be able to influence that data and say, well, hey, this is wrong data. Could you please change this? Or actually actively change it yourself. And this is also actually, of course, highly dependent on what data we're talking about, what legal regimes we have, and so on. So there needs to be some setup between there. There are some tools out there, and there are some things developing right now. One is the Google dashboard. I'm not sure if anybody has looked at that. But if you log in to Google, if you have a Google account, you can see some of the data that Google has stored on you and some of the trails you do have there. But you need a Google account. You cannot just do it anonymously, which is a sort of a drawback. There's also a couple of governmental efforts going around. I think Norway is starting up something called MinSida. There's other governmental portals coming up where you can access what data different departments and different organizations within the government has stored about you, for what purposes. And the last one is the most tricky one, of course. This is access to profiles, or actually getting access to them or control them, profiles that may affect you. And this is a tricky bit because we're recently just seeing these things coming into privacy area. Before, you could always say, well, it's not personal data. Well, if I'm doing something and what I'm doing is sort of influencing what happens to me, then it suddenly becomes part of that. So we really need to be able as well to see what are the consequences of doing things. And this is the tricky part. There's no tools out there now. We're not really sure how to actually do this in a good manner, but it's what you might call counter-profiling. What if tools? What if I do this? What will happen then? Okay. So why do we need them then? Well, if you look at the internet today, we leave traces all around the place. And the traditional view of privacy has been to keep data secret. We now know that that data leaks around. So even if we try to keep it secret, it can still leak. So the idea here is, of course, to see, okay, combine the concealment with a possibility at least to see where this data comes from and where it's used to. There's also other emerging technologies, as I talk about, most famously AMI, ambient intelligence systems, where you actually have environments that react to how you behave and what you do and so on. In those environments, it's quite hard to conceal data. However, you might want to be able to at least understand the consequences of what's happening. So that's the whole idea there. Then there's the fact, actually, that most European computer laws, or data protection laws, I should say, actually has a requirement on transparency. However, they're written long ago, so the rights you have currently is to ask any data controller once a year, and then you will get a printout on paper of the information they have stored about you. How you have to ask is different under different jurisdictions right now. So we can say that there's a legal support. However, we cannot say that there's a legal support for automatic tools. However, we believe that having this capability in an automatic tool will actually make the process easier for both the companies and the users out there. And probably cheaper as well, depending on how it's set up. Okay. There's a lot of risks here, of course, as well. If you're providing access to private information to me, about me, there's always a risk that somebody else tries to get that information. And specifically, if you have good tools collecting information about me out there, there's a lot of information that could potentially be misused in case there's a breach. So these types of tools require strong authentication, more or less. But remember, I'm saying strong authentication here. I'm not saying strong identification. You actually need to prove that you have the right, but you don't need to prove that you're the person, right? So there's tools around here to actually provide more or less anonymous access or pseudonymous access to these systems in a secure way. So it doesn't really mean that we need to identify people in order to do this. We just need to strongly authenticate them. And the other thing is, of course, that if we want to know what's been done with our data, there is a need to do excessive logging on what's happening with those data. And we have to make sure that that logging is not producing new privacy-sensitive data or new personal data in the process. Okay, so some examples of what's not really out there, but in the research right now, because we're just starting this area more or less, or for the last 4 or 5 years. This is TAMI. It's a project at MIT, and the idea here is that they're seeing that law enforcement is using more and more data mining in order to track criminals or track traffic. So the idea here is, of course, to generate some form of proof on what has been done and why these things have been done. So up there, you have a number of data sources. The data sources goes to something that is an inference engine. And what that does is actually it will mine the data for things that can be asserted or proved there. The result of that would most likely, if a law enforcement officer sees it, lead to some form of adverse action, i.e. either they arrest you, or they will pick you in for interrogation, or they will block you from flying, or things like that. The information used is then stored in the TMS. And the TMS stores the information that been used for this decision and where that information came from, the antecedents of that. And then later, you can generate a proof based on usage rules here that the action you actually took was the correct one. And there's numerous examples they give. Among other things, they give the notion of a deadbeat dad that is stopped on a no-fly list. So basically, he's hauled in as a terrorist, and then the information is spread all over the police organization, ending up at the local police, which use him to arrest him for deadbeat dad. And in the American legal system, this is not legal, so this is actually forbidden. So from a legal standpoint, this would work well in the Anglo-Saxon legal systems, wouldn't work in the Swedish legal system, because we don't have the concept of illegal evidence. The evidence is freely proven by the courts, right? But in this case, you can actually say, well, you weren't allowed to use this evidence for these things. However, it could be a good infrastructure to trace automatic decisions on you as well and see were there good basis for these automatic decisions or not, for complaints later on. The other one is a system that is under development of Sackmann and Stricker in Germany. And the idea here is for an ambient intelligence system. In this case, you have a policy that you commit to the system. And the system will then log all the information it connects on you. The log files can be viewed by a log viewer, so you can actually go in and see the logs. And the logs are protected, but they're standard secure logs used. And then later on, I can take my log view record, push it to an automatic audit, and this automatic audit will then produce a report for me. And the interesting thing here is, of course, that you will see any policy violations immediately from these things. And another interesting thing here is that they actually check this by converting the whole policy. So they will see how to break it and then see if they find breakages in it. Okay. Another which comes under what we talked about before, history functions. This is DataTrack, which is part of the PrimeLife project. And it's tied to the Prime Core that Simone talked a little bit about before when you access certain places. The Prime Core will store data about you in different databases. And the whole idea of the data track later on is that that collects data from the different places, presents them, and then you have the possibility of talking to the other side and see what is stored there about you as well and compare the two. So this is a typical example of a very simple first view in the data track. And the biggest problem here is, of course, not maybe... Well, there's some problem in collecting the data since most of the data on the network is not marked. That's why we need the Prime Core currently. However, the biggest problem is, of course, how to present this information to a user in a good, understandable way. So we're doing quite heavily user tests on these things and see how people react and so on. But basically, the idea here is, of course, to collect the data that is used and then present it in a good manner. And on the top level here, you will see all the sites that I have visited or that the person in this has visited and the different time periods and where it's visited. And if you click on the arrows, you will get individual sessions here. If you double-click on one of the individual sessions, you will get this. And this is basically this session. It's the data I released. It's what's stored on me on the remote side. and it's the purpose for which I released it, and who, if any, verified this. And in this case, the identifier is verified by Transport Styrelsen, so you can guess that it's from a driving license, more or less. Clicking on the summary, you will get the same, but you will get it for all sessions I had with these things. So this is an example of a history transparency tool. And of course, there's a number of things I could do here which we didn't show, but if you have the right negotiations with the other side and so on, you can ask to change the data directly, to delete data, or to actually change data on the remote side. And if the data on the remote side have collected more data than I have given, that would also have shown up here, but then there would have been empty slots here, and it would be marked as red in this case. Okay, so there were some examples of the history tools or what's been done with my data tools, policy violations. We're also looking into log system and privacy-preserving secure logs. And the reason for that is, of course, that there is a need to know. If we want to have transparency, there is a need to know how data has been handled. We really do want to have real-time access to it, and we want to detect policy violations. You saw an example with the accuracy log there. And the most important of all, I think, it should not reveal new personal information to others. So we should not create a new source of new personal information. So what do we require then? Well, if you look at it at this, I mean, all of you probably know what a log is. It's just a recorded sequential data with timestamps and other things that make it unique. 10 years ago, oh, sorry, it's even more. It's 20 years ago. The notion of secure logs or logs that could still function in hostile environments were discussed quite heavily, and there was a number of ideas there. And the idea here is, of course, to protect the confidentiality and the integrity of all the entries as well. Usually, confidentiality is used by using encryption. And in most of the cases, you have what's called a session key here. And integrity is provided by hash chains and MAC chains. And it's important to note that, and this goes for all of them, these logs are only protected as long as the system is not under attack. So the whole idea is actually to preserve history, what has happened. Once an attacker has full control of the system, there's nothing we can do even in the log files. I mean, then you can produce, fabricate logs as you see fit. So they give what has a different number of different names, but forward secrecy, forward integrity, or forward security, dependent on who you talk with. Okay, so what do we want more then? Well, we want a secure log, but we want to add things. One of them is that we only want the data subject for whom the log entries concern to be able to read this. And please keep in mind now, we're taking an extreme view to begin with. We can always relax this later on. If we just say first that it's only the data subject, we can only relax it backwards and say, okay, let's make the data subject and the auditor be able to read this, and so on. But once things are committed to the log, we only want the data subject to be able to read it. We want unlinkabilities between data subject entries, i.e. we don't want anybody that can get hold of this log to be able to link entries and say that these entries belong to that data subject, or even that these entries belong together. And we want independent integrity validation, i.e. basically we don't want to have the whole log in order to be able to verify the integrity. We want the user to be able to identify the integrity of the records that belongs to him. So this is what we want against an adversaries or the things that we need. And for those of you who are into the crypto side, what we really need is a chemdem hybrid cipher. It's basically a fancy way of saying that we're using a symmetric session key encrypted in a private key. So the normal way you would create session keys, but we do one for each log entry here. And there needs to be encryption schemes with key privacy, and that has to do with unlinkability. There are certain, or a lot of the public key schemes will actually make it possible for you to see who has encrypted this entry, what key has encrypted this entry, statistically. Okay, so I'm just going to run to this. We actually made such an environment, implemented it, and it works quite well. It's based on an extension of the KSysNier secure log, for those of you that are interested in that. So it's actually possible to achieve these things, and we're now looking at how to achieve it over a distributed environment. So, thanks for me.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much, Hans. So we can take questions on this later. Maybe just to add for the data track, should we also mention that the history database for the end user is also kept on a very secure environment and user's computer, so it should not be used by others to see all the user's history.
The history data is encrypted and stored on the user's platform, or it could be stored on a USB stick if you want portable things.
But we can discuss this more. Now we have the last presentation by Lothar on privacy-enhancing identity management in the context of location-based services, which have been also implemented with commercial partners and also on the business aspects of PETs and privacy-enhancing identity management.
Okay, does this work? Yes. Good day. Welcome to the third presentation of the session. My name is Lothar Fritsch. I work for the Norwegian Computing Center, Norsk Regnesentral in Oslo. I've been working with Simone on a Prime project before. And my topic is location privacy by design, technology, and business incentives for that. And what actually we'll talk about is what is location privacy? We're in the age where almost everybody has a smartphone with a GPS, and we all use things like Google Maps and navigation units on cars. And pretty soon we're going to have whatever social communities on our mobile phones that automatically send messages to friends that are in the same bar district of town. Do we really want that, or how do we want that? That's the topic of the first section. The second section will be privacy by design, where I'll talk about the right order of doing things. And the third section is about reasons for businesses to actually care and spend some extra money. Well, for motivation first, this is a map of a Greek island. And if we today use the mobile client Google Maps or mobile Facebook or whatever, together with geotagging on the images, and we walk around on the island on our holidays or on a conference, and we upload pictures or blog messages to our friends, like the middle picture is showing, they all get a date stamp, the pictures get a location stamp. So what this actually creates is the picture on the right. I mean, anyone with access to either my Facebook page or the Facebook database gets a pretty good idea of where I have been at what time. And if they got more than one Facebook user walking around on the island, they also get the idea about who I might have met. And I wonder if you want that all the time. There's, of course, a couple of things one could do about it. I could have five Facebook accounts and switch between these pseudonymous accounts all the time. But that, of course, does not help if I leave a trail and it all ends up in the same database where the observer actually sees that I'm leaving pseudonym A and switching to pseudonym B in the same place, and then pseudonym B just keeps walking down the road that pseudonym A has disappeared on. So that simple mechanism of just make five accounts and use them, that does not work. There's the mixing technology that Simone was explaining that is out there with Tor and other anonymizers that many of us use already for various purposes, most of them surfing the net in the office without the boss knowing, I assume. But here the problem is that many of the services actually require me to log in with my email address or with my name or with an account I get somewhere from an open ID provider that in the end is named Google or Yahoo. So I'm having perfectly anonymous connections, but the service provider still knows who I am and gets his profile on the map. So that alone does not work either. There's a number of things that have been discovered in research and discussed for a couple of years. One concept is called cloaking in time and space. That comes from a cloak, like a piece of clothing I can hide in. And time cloaking, that of course means that I set restrictions on the time intervals somebody can track me. But there's no need for any service to track me every second. Maybe I just want to be tracked once an hour, or maybe for an office application just between 8 o'clock and 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So that's called time cloaking. Another strategy that will be space cloaking, where I basically define areas on my city map and say, look, in my whole quarter where I'm home, I don't want to be tracked at all, dot. And that's called spatial cloaking. Both of these technologies are very easy. They basically leave us a policy on a database, more or less. There are more complicated things. Mixed zoning is one of them. It's based on a concept called K-anonymity. K-anonymity basically says that if there is K people moving around in an area, but the service provider has no idea which of these K is actually me, then I have K-anonymity. In plain language, you're hiding in a crowd, and the guy observing can't tell which of these is you. And then, of course, a mixed zone is a geographic area, let's say a circle of 1 kilometer around the central station in Stockholm, and the whole infrastructure that is providing the location bits to service providers is making sure that there's no detail information getting out that is better than 1 kilometer. And that way, you automatically start hiding in a mixed zone with everybody else who walks around the central station in Stockholm. Of course, to get that done really right, you probably have to have a couple of avatars of yourself walking around on the map and switch between them. I've had a master's student once who implemented a map-based tool where he read lots of urban sociology articles to find out how people behave while they walk in the urban space. And it's quite interesting. It ended with a program where you could describe yourself in a couple of parameters, like your affinity to shopping windows or whether you were on free time or business leave. And it could create a crowd of 10 avatars randomly walking the city, but in your moving patterns. So that would be an option to, instead of just having one iPhone with one app that completely all the time tells everybody where I am, to just have a software that copies 10 copies of me that randomly walk around all the time, and the only person who has control over releasing the real identity, that is me. These things are, of course, very complicated, and as you guess it, it depends on where the location is from. Is it the GPS on your own phone, or is it maybe the mobile network that you're in, or the IP address of your internet provider? That is very difficult these days in practice. Wi-Fi hotspots, mobile internet, everything is more or less bound to a subscriber account. So what we did in the Prime project, the first bullet up here, is that we tried to cooperate with T-Mobile to find out how could we set up an infrastructure that at the mobile provider that has all the location data would enable a mechanism that protects location information while it is sent to application providers. I'll describe this in a few slides down. The second concept, that's a complicated cryptographic algorithm called oblivious transfer that was applied to mapping servers with some friends at KU Leuven in Belgium, where we basically, the problem was that we have people accessing a mapping service like Google Maps or anything else that looks more or less like that. But the mapping service should have no idea about who is accessing which part of the map while at the same time getting paid. I'll have a few brief words on that as well. In the Prime project with T-Mobile, the challenge there was that, of course, T-Mobile thought a bit about how to enable location-based services with mobile phones. In their view, of course, the location data would come from the mobile phone network because there's millions of legacy phones out there that don't have GPS, and no one will pay them money just to access the 10% smartphones that are out there. So it was pretty much a precondition that we work with the network cell location capabilities and things like that. And on the other hand, T-Mobile is hardly selling any applications of their own, but they're selling interfaces to the infrastructure for somebody else to make applications and then bill their customers and pay a share to T-Mobile. Most of the big telecommunication companies have been doing that for most of the time until Apple came. So their requirement was that whatever we do, we must be able to delegate the whole service to third parties, but we must be in a position to control what they're doing and, most important, to be legally safe against anyone who is unhappy about giving location data to somebody else. So a couple of requirements that came out of that was that there should be a secure, privacy-friendly architecture that is also referencing the current legislation in Europe. The solution should actually be affordable to a real company rolling it out on their infrastructure. And the user should be able to manage a couple of policies about what happens with their location information when they actually allow third-party LBS providers to access it. There should never, ever be a violation of one of the user's policies because that is right from the data protection law. And then it should be very effective hiding usage patterns because if you make a mistake in specifying this, then it would be very easy for the telecom provider to see which services you're using at what times and what they're doing. It would get a pretty good idea about when, how often, and possibly where you're using the online dating service versus the online navigation service. So that's what's not supposed to be happening. And then, of course, confidentiality of communication against external observers. That's a very interesting topic with laws that we got in the recent times about data retention and all kinds of things that just get recorded for months. What we ended up in the end after discussions and research was a principle that is hidden in this diagram where we build a border between the electronic identity that is known at the telecom provider and the electronic identity that is known to the third-party service providers. And what you see in the picture, on the right, the orange box in the middle, that is a component that was called the location matcher. And what it actually does is it does match the telecom identity versus the electronic identity at the LBS provider. And the process that is supposed to happen in here is that whenever the user from the mobile phone on the left connects the LBS service provider on top, the LBS service provider has to go and ask the location matcher, hey, can I please have this user's location? The location matcher on the other side knows which mobile provider to talk to, and the mobile provider on the bottom, that actually is storing the rules the user set. So what will happen is that there comes a request from the top to the location matcher that says, the user known to me as user A wishes to get its location so I can provide a service. That message gets decoded by the matcher and sent further down to the location system where he says, well, your user B is actually using a service. Please give me the location for service with service ID number 10. And then down here, there will be a rule that says, well, service number 10 is only allowed to see me between 8 and 4 and only when I'm not in my home area. And that all was implemented based on mixing technology on some cryptographic algorithms that create credentials that can be shown to someone else without showing identity to someone else. And it was test implemented in the project. And as far as I know, some bits of this have actually been implemented by T-Mobile just to enable them to prove to anyone who challenged them in court that they actually implemented the requirements for data protection when they connect third-party location providers. Very, very brief bit on oblivious maps. This is based on a cryptographic algorithm that is a multi-party computation algorithm, very complicated things I'm not getting into. What it basically does is the map world on the mapping server to the left, that is organized in tiles. Mostly everybody is doing that, Google included, to split the map in tiles and then send tiles to the client. But here, there is a party in the middle, which is a cryptographic system. And the users on the right, with some cryptographic initialization, they can request a particular position. And the positions in the middle part, they all get mapped on one of the tiles. And the whole game is going through a cryptographic algorithm that bundles requests to the same tile. And the only thing the mapping server ever gets to see is that there is a unknown group of people accessing the same tile, and they get the same tile sent back. But the algorithm includes a way to actually pay the mapping server for doing that. But this is a bit more than the usual HTTP request and sending back something through SSL. It actually requires planning ahead of the service of that. So that is privacy by design that's needed. There's a publication about this, which I reference in the annex. If you're interested, please take contact or get the presentation from the organizer. Next step, privacy by design. Well, why? I called it planning versus patching. And the reason is that according to all surveys and research you see, the cost of software maintenance explodes the further down you are in the software development process. And it seems to be an exponential growth from design of a building to deployment phase. And I would assume, in my experience and in my observation, that concepts like data security, data protection, privacy, and the choice of the right identity management system that can handle either anonymous IDs or not, these are really basic decisions made when designing software. But when you come to the deployment phase and you find out that you actually have chosen the wrong EID scheme, the wrong identity management scheme, that can basically destroy the whole application. So what is one of the rationales for having privacy by design from the very beginning is to save a lot of money. And then one of the prominent examples out there, that is Facebook again. At some time this year, I think it was in February, the Privacy Commissioner of Ontario in Canada has decided that Facebook should not get away longer with $50 fines for not following data protection. And they basically set an ultimatum and said, either you'll improve privacy up to Canadian law or Facebook will be illegal in Canada. And ever since, Facebook has been struggling, basically changing some basic internal things about every 3 weeks. And that costs a lot of money. It irritates lots of users. And it kind of destroys the application experience. Once you get used to the new settings, they keep changing. That is, it's not very, very beneficial for someone who needs to make money with their applications. Privacy by design is basically a process that starts with finding out what the stakeholders' stakes are in step one, where the rules are basically what is the information system about, who's involved, what is at risk? What are they doing? Why are they doing it? And who is in control? And following that, you could find out if they actually are talking about the same. That's the step two. Because if you get a number of people from the IT industry in one room and ask them, please, what is privacy and data protection? You'll probably get a couple of interesting answers. Like the guys that come from the legal discipline, they say, well, this is an immediate consequence of fundamental human rights. It cannot be negotiated. If you ask someone coming in from a telecommunications company, he will say, well, privacy is the cheapest way of getting rid of compliance requirements. That sounds different from fundamental human rights. And that game goes on, depending on who you ask. So when you get three people in and they say, yeah, please support privacy, and you don't investigate on that, they probably haven't talked about the same concept at all. Well, the third step, that will be a high-level specification about what the system is about, what security levels it should keep, what measures should be there, possibly how much budget there is to implement them. And then there is a step four, that is a multilateral security analysis, where you go through the specification against all the stakeholders' interests and find out, is the infrastructure actually supporting all stakeholders? And you will be surprised to see that many systems out there that we all use every day, they have interesting features when you perform this step number four on them. Think of your online banking account or your credit card. These infrastructures are there to make sure that the bank is not losing money. They're not there to make sure that I'm not losing any money. Because if you see in the age of identity theft, still people do issue credit cards with magnetic strips with numbers on them that can be stolen, faxed to Indonesia, and used there. Why? I mean, this technology is outdated, but the whole system is set up in a way that the bank can prove everything they want, but the user cannot prove anything. If it wasn't that way, it wouldn't happen any longer. And if you look at your online banking, you have to enter PIN codes from a number token to basically sign every single transaction you do in your online bank, but are you getting back a kind of a signed receipt from your bank for that, just in case you disagree a week later? Probably not. And five, That is, as a consequence, the detailed specification of the security infrastructure that follows from step four. And that, of course, includes where is the data, how much do we need, should it be encrypted, who is getting access to it, do we need this data after all, or can we perform the transaction without collecting the data using anonymous credentials and other technologies that were introduced by Simone and Hans. All right, I have to jump a bit and keep the time schedule. Basically, the stakeholder consensus in case of location-based service is depicted in this picture where there's a solution space in the middle that is negotiable between all the stakeholders. But a better should be in the middle of all stakeholders and not somewhere on the edge. And what we unfortunately see a lot today, especially when it comes to mobile phones and smartphones and apps and fancy social network applications, is that the definition of where this consensus is mostly done by the telecommunications business alone. So that will be difficult in terms of changing the infrastructure later and negotiating the other interests into it. Let's go to part three, the business incentives. It's a bit of a trouble in privacy research that for 25 years there have been anonymizers around and good scientific advice on what data to collect and not. But all these things have been complicated and they cost money and you need extra software engineers to do an extra privacy by design cycle. So that costs money. And aren't we in the age of everything's for free on the internet and open source and so on and so on? Well, there's a couple of things that businesses should be interested in too. And just for the purpose of the coming slides, there's two things about data protection. On the left side, that is about the data that is being stored. And that's the classic view of data protection. What piles up in databases? What does anyone know about a person? But on the right side, that is very important, the identifiers that are pointing to the real people together with the data. That's a part that is not very often talked about out there, outside of science these days. We do have lots of identity schemes, a credit card number, a citizen number, a social security number, an email address. And up to today, it is hardly regulated about who is allowed to produce these electronic identities or who is allowed to use them. And the only scheme that's out there that is heavily regulated, that is passports. No one's allowed to produce passports but the government. And there's a good reason for that we all know. And a similar scheme for electronic identity seems to be missing widely on the market. Now, everybody can put out an identity scheme and everybody else seems to be allowed to use it. And that creates problems. Back to business. What happens to businesses if they run out of bad privacy? Think again of Facebook this February. There's lots of reputation damage, and reputation damage is money in terms of branding damage, in terms of customers running away. Worse than customer loss is a competitive loss, which translates to the customer runs away from me, but he signs up with my competitor. That's even worse than just losing customers. And then, of course, a loss of business. If I have bad reputation with the other suppliers, they kick me out of their supply chain. Then there's legal compliance, which costs a lot of money. There will be audits from the data protection authorities. They will set up fines. After the fines, a company that constantly does not follow regulation might end up on a blacklist for government tenders where they stay for 10 years. And there's lots of fees for legal processing and legal battling with the authorities all the time. And maybe some contract partners will refuse to pay their bills if my own reputation says that I'm never following any regulation. And then there's the management cost, the total cost of ownership. Yeah, we bought the cheap system. We just downloaded and compiled open source stuff. We skipped the design phase. But then the customers keep bringing in, complaining. I have to manage all these data protection audits. That's a lot of cost that it's coming out of not realizing the cost in the design phase. There's risk management. The nice process of constantly monitoring the cert advisories, patching your infrastructure, running new patches. The new patch will destroy your old application. That is risk management cost. That is happening all the time. And then training, of course. Staff needs to be trained. Staff needs to be up to level with new privacy regulations. Maybe regulation has changed, and what are you doing then? You have to retrain all the staff to not do certain database queries if your database just executes them when you enter them. That is very, very expensive. In the end, This is a summary. On the left side, there's a couple of things that are going to cost money to businesses if privacy is bad on their systems. And what is often talked about in the media and in the discourse is the right side, the risks to the users of IT systems. But things can easily put a business out of business if things go wrong. And that's very nice illustrated by the next example. Everybody in Europe is currently really fancy about putting RFID tags on consumer items for food tracing, food safety. And this example is looking at fish, because fish is a food that is very delicate and that turns poisonous really fast. So everybody is talking about food safety, putting all the data, the producer, and the things right on the fish box in the supermarket. And what you could, of course, easily do is, I know there is an issue between Norway and Sweden about farming fish in Norway, while the Swedish consumers seem to be a bit more aware about some conditions in where the fish is coming from. So just imagine a phone application that can read RFID tags and the consumer just scanning their shopping cart with it, and the phone says, no, bad fish, leave it here. And, of course, this is an app downloaded from the App Store, which was made by whoever, Greenpeace or the World Wildlife Fund, or maybe just your competitor. You have no control over it whatsoever if you're using RFID tags that talk to everybody else. That is exactly the problem that the consumer advocates are always scared of, with tags on things that consumers can handle. But these tags talk to everyone, your competitor included. So be aware of that. So what will happen is that, of course, the phone will tell you, boycott this. This is bad fish. Or even worse, it could say boycott all Norwegian fish because Norway is not doing it right, like there seems to be a lot of discussion in Canada lately. Or even worse, the supermarket on the other side of the street just tells you, look, we got it cheaper, all based on the RFID tag that you paid for. And then there's more of these scenarios where if you just think about the privacy fears that consumers are having, this is going to hit businesses hard. You know, you're going to be taxed depending on the RFID tag trash of your consumer product packages on the waste dump. Or maybe your trash pile is turning up in Nigeria or any other third world country anytime soon, and it has not supposed to have been there ever. It was whichever mafia that put it there, but it still has the RFID tags with your name on it. How are we going to explain this? So in the end, this is the summary slide. Please do consider privacy by design with a long-term perspective. Otherwise, your RFID tags might turn up on some very inconvenient trash pile sometime in the future. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Lothar. I think that was rounding up very nicely and also puts it in an organizational context. So we have now 10 minutes remaining for questions or comments on your experiences on pets, implement privacy by design. Yes, I think we have also a microphone, and this gentleman goes around so that everybody can be heard very well.
Well, I have a question about end-user costs. Will this cost the end-user anything, or will the privacy be included in what application you might need from the beginning?
End-user. You want to?
Shall I volunteer?
Yeah.
Well, most products, things that cost money will end up in the product price. That is the case with security-certified parts in cars, for example. There are standards, but by standardizing things, things also get cheaper. Maybe Hans will have a comment on that. But if you think of free things on the internet these days, I quote a person from Gemalto, a smart car producer in France, who just said to me in Brussels 2 weeks ago that if you sign up to a service for free, you should expect that it is you who is being sold by the service to someone else. And you do make a conscious decision as a consumer or a user to maybe invest a euro or two more in some place just because it's certified. While the cheap things you use, that's like a second-hand car that is not certified any longer, that didn't go to inspection. So it's about expectations.
I can
I can comment one thing on that as well, and that is, as Lothar said, as things get standardized and if those things are open, it's also highly more likely that somebody from the open source community or things like that get into it if we have standardized protocols, standardized way of talking between applications. But otherwise, I mean, yeah, it's a question of some stuff is certainly going to cost, others might be free through the open source community.
Mm-hmm. Then there was another question. Yeah.
Okay.
It seems that the end user is expected to manage a privacy policy or something. Is that correct? Or
yeah, no? Well, yeah, well, you have to define your privacy preferences on your user side. But of course, here usability is also quite important. So our idea is that it comes with predefined sets of privacy preferences from which the user can choose from and which he can also adapt on the fly, that you, for instance, have one predefined preference that the user wants to be anonymous, or another one only releasing minimal data for a certain application, he can also adapt it when he visits a site and is willing to give away more data. He can also configure his predefined one and save it under another name, for instance, so that it makes it more simple to use the preferences.
Okay, for example, Facebook, they have sort of questions if you want to give your information to a Facebook application, but I think no one seems to care. They just answer yes always because they want the application, so they don't care about which information they are sending out. So how are you going to make this understandable and at the same time easy to use?
Mm-hmm. So the idea is to make really the policies more transparent. So Facebook is a very good example. There you have a privacy policy in a written legal text of 15 pages that I'm sure nobody has read when they click OK. So you have a long legal text. Usually users only click the box, OK, I consent, but have not really read and understood that they sign away the rights for all the data to Facebook at the same time. So the idea is really to have automatically readable policies that can visualize to the user very prominently what are the key elements of the policy and match it with the expectation of the users in regard to privacy.
That's what we're trying to look at very much, to see as much as possible into the machines. But then there are some legal problems. That's why when we have the stored policy, for example, in the data track, we actually have to have a snapshot of the page because we later have, if there's a dispute, we have to show the text that the user actually saw on the other side. But the whole idea is, of course, to try to find, and maybe if we find more standardized ways that we have today in expressing these things, we could have more machine negotiation, and we could have, for example, NGOs or data inspection or whoever who do predefined policies and say, this is what we think are good ones. And then you get a warning, more or less. And I'm pretty sure users will click away the warning anyway, but in a way to get the attention that something is happening here, so please take an extra caution. So, yeah.
In addition, I'd just like to point out that most things that mankind has invented had some dangerous side effects, and they got regulated in a socio-economic ecosystem later with laws and instruction on how to use it. You know, that when the car was invented, it was, of course, easy to run people over with the car by going too fast in a city. So you got these regulations around it about speed limits and at the same time telling all the people to look left and right first and then run over the road. And that also has to happen with software and internet applications. And then, in my opinion, especially in Scandinavia, where people pay a lot of taxes to governments they have big trust in, they probably assume if it's legal, then the government thinks it's okay. Well, that is probably a bit dependent on the local culture where you are, but that seems to be an invariant in many places in the world. And as long as it's legal out in the open, it's probably okay.
Yes, I think Vivica had a question.
Yes, my question simply is about the necessity to actually implement it from the point of view of the general user. I mean, I absolutely agree that there is a need for this. And I think Hans actually more or less implicitly commented on saying that, well, people click anyway, even if we have these standardized policies. Have you any plans for really sort of educating, for example, journalists or someone else that can actually make these problems more clear to the users so that they can see the danger before they are hit?
Well, we're trying in some way, I think, but things are not really interesting until it really happens, right? So you might get overrun by a car tomorrow, but, well, as long as you're not overrun, it's not a big issue. So I think the what we're seeing now is more, I mean, going back to when we started, but now things are popping up more and more, and people start to realize, I think, that it's not just about sort of giving away my data as my nosy neighbor is looking at me, but actually recent attacks when you sort of give away information on Facebook and somebody goes and reads that and can use that to get your password through the what was my teacher named in the third grade things, might get people to understand a little bit more the connection. However, yeah, it's tricky. We're trying as much as we can, but it's only high profile when something happens, right? So yeah. And usually you're sort of, we don't want to cry wolf too much either.
Yes, the idea is of pets, of course, also to protect the non-expert users. But of course, users need to get interested, first of all, to use pets, unless they are implemented in the infrastructure. Yes. Two more minutes? No? Yeah? Yes?
I have a question on the, let's say, binary nature of privacy-enhancing technologies. Is it, have you seen any development towards, let's say, a dynamic approach to PETs? I'm a PhD student at the Swedish National Defense College, and we're seeing in the military sector, in future military communications, that privacy-enhancing technologies might be useful in, let's say, hiding location-based information from an adversary or even protecting the soldiers themselves. But in some cases, like if you have an attack or in some cases you might want to see where a person is or getting to know some of this privacy-related information. So I'm thinking that there's been some research done in this area that you know of.
What?
If you could comment on that, thanks.
So, yes, there's indeed some research how to design pets also that they are accountable in case of misuse. So this is not always an easy problem, but it is indeed there are solutions out. Yeah, also for anonymization services. For instance, the YAP service that is run by the TU Dresden and other providers in Germany has such a backdoor in case of misuse. So the idea is, so YAP is a mixed net, which is based on a so-called mixed cascade, that a certain number, predefined sequence of mixes is always traversed for the traffic. And it's operated by the Technical University of Dresden, the Data Protection Commission in Schleswig-Holstein, I think the University in Regensburg, and these are the actors. And the backdoor is as follows, which was required by German law enforcement. In case that the last mix node detects that a website with illegal material, in particular child pornographic material, is accessed, only in this circumstances the path can be followed back to the initial sender. So there's a backdoor that the user is anonymous as far as he behaves in a legal sense, but as soon as he accesses illegal websites like websites with children pornography. In that situation, the path can be followed back and the user can be identified. So then there were some ideas how to make it more cryptographically secure to guarantee that only in this situation it can be followed back and only by law enforcement, not by the mixed servers themselves and so on. So there are also some publications on that, and I think that is currently implemented. Of course, then you have the other side, that these mixed services are also used in countries with non-democratic systems, like in China or in other countries. Citizens would like to use it to communicate anonymously, and then, of course, their government could also misuse this backdoor function. So it is not easy to say. It can be a good idea, but it can be also misused on the other side. But indeed, there is some research on that also.
Yeah, the other example is the anonymous credentials pseudonymous credentials you were talking about, because they can be designed in a number of different ways. One could, for example, be that you actually need you split the access to who is actually having this among three parties, so they have to go together. Or you could do a misuse detection. So if the same thing is used twice, but you're only allowed once, you can always go back. But if you just use it once, you cannot go back. So there are, we're quite aware of these things.
Mm. Yeah, there's a publication by Jan Kamenisch et al. On anonymous yet accountable access. Yeah. I think it's a paper, and the other one on revocable anonymity is by Stefan Köpsel and others at Springer LNCS in 2006, I think. So.
In addition, I would imagine that depending on your particular requirements, most of these mix principles are based on K anonymity, where K is preferably big before the mix pushes out the next batch of messages. But, if you want to follow a small tactical group of soldiers in the field, you could probably reduce K dynamically to get smaller batches out. And the same holds for the oblivious transfer mapping example. You could just get the mapping tiles smaller on demand when there's nothing happening, you get one big tile, no one knows where the groups are, but in those decisive 10 tactical minutes, you get the tiles small enough so you can actually see where they're moving. I think these algorithms are, in principle, adjustable. Just as you could use different sets of anonymous credentials, one for generic anonymous authentication in communication and one where that is actually only used if someone with a particular function asks for something, like air support.
I think the reason why you see it as black and white is that you see that as either not anonymous or anonymous. And the reason why we always go for anonymous is because this is the hardest case to get. So if we get to anonymous, you can always reasonably well track back and add information that makes it possible to de-anonymize later on.
Okay. So, unfortunately, we are running out of time. But if you have further questions, you can contact us. We are here all day and are happy to discuss further. In my function as a moderator, I also have the pleasure to have here two gifts for my co-speakers.
Thank you.
That I want to thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thanks also for the questions. And I said there's another session right after on anonymous communication and Tor, which will probably also be quite interesting. Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm.